So continuing to think about Washington, D.C. and the fiasco taking place underneath the Capitol Dome, let's just forget the argument over whether this is the wrong way to run things, if it's hostage-taking, if it's a meat-cleaver approach to the budget, the irresponsible level of debt, it's off-limits to use the debt limit and possible default as a threat. Maybe 10 days into the government shutdown and 7 months of living at the bottom of the fiscal cliff, remember the fiscal cliff, we're 7 months into sequestration, and 7 days away from the debt limit deadline, you know, maybe these are the new rules. Maybe this is how America makes fiscal policy now, cuts spending, produces consensus, may have more of the blood and gore of a zombie movie and less of the heroics of Lois Lane being hoisted out of danger by the Man of Steel. But folks, this is where we are. Maybe sequestration and the shutdown show us what is actually wasteful and inessential. Maybe this is the best way for us to reduce government spending in America. Joining us to discuss this is Nick Gillespie. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
Nick is editor-in-chief of Reason.com and Reason TV. Also with us, Ryan Alexander, president of Taxpayers for Common Sense. Welcome, Ryan.
Thanks for having me, too.
So, Ryan, should we just forget about the stylistic issues here and just go, you know what, this actually works. Let's just adopt this approach to fiscal spending reductions. What have we learned over the last 7 months of sequestration and the last 10 days of government shutdown?
I don't think we should forget about the hard decision-making that they're not making because, yeah, we're moving this way. This is where we are. But they still aren't making hard decisions. They're still kind of cutting the good and the bad equally, and they can't identify things that people agree on, even though there is stuff that we can cut. There's absolutely stuff government can cut. There's no question about that. But sequestration is you know, kind of a blunt instrument. The government shutdown isn't really showing us what's essential and non-essential. It's actually, you know, a pretty partial government shutdown. So it turns out that by the kind of arbitrary definition that we're using to determine who's exempt and who's not exempt, you know, most of the government's not exempt. I think this is just a blunt instrument. But that said, it keeps the pressure on to actually make some difficult decisions and say, gosh, do we really need the market access program to help agricultural interests market their products abroad? Probably not. We don't need that. I hope that they actually cut some of those things that are more obvious. But sequestration didn't lead to that. The Budget Control Act didn't lead to that. The super committee didn't come up with a single dollar of deficit reduction. So I think it's good that we got some pressure on, but it hasn't actually shown us the way.
Sequestration, saving money, government shutdown, saving money, and ultimately that's a net positive, Nick Gillespie?
Well, it's good in the sense that I think it does force us to do at least some cost-benefit analyses, or it lays open the possibility for that. But I agree with Ryan that we're not learning anything new from this. What this has kind of done is force us to actually cut some spending. Sequestration is ridiculous in terms of the total amount of money it's saving, somewhere between 1% and 2% of overall federal spending for a number of years. And even under the first year of sequestration, total federal spending went up. So when people say it's a meat cleaver approach, it's really kind of like, you know, a meat cleaver that you would use as a Monopoly icon or something. It's a tiny little meat cleaver, and it's only cutting in on discretionary spending or one part of the budget where, in a lot of ways, the biggest problems, and this isn't to scant the fact that the defense spending should be cut massively. There is just no justification for that. Things like farm subsidies should be cut massively. Lots of other things could be cut massively with no net negative effect. But the real action is on the what's called the mandatory side, things like entitlements, particularly Medicare and Social Security, which are programs which are absolutely unsustainable. And those are the things that take up most of the budget.
So the rhetoric from Washington that a government shutdown is actually the greatest pain producer, it sounds like what Nick Gillespie is saying, Ryan, is that no, actually it's not. That in fact, this turns out to be one of the least painful ways to at least go through the illusion of making hard decisions. Would you go along with that, Ryan?
I would say sequestration is one of the least painful ways to make hard decisions. I think the thing about the government shutdown is it is kind of a sideshow, but there's pain. There's, 800,000 people not getting paid, and they'll probably get back pay, but that doesn't mean they didn't have to pay their mortgage on October 1st and not get a paycheck.
No, we've heard from them. It's been painful stories we've been hearing all week.
You know, and then there's, all the kind of businesses that depend on those people. And then, we're not actually saving money. It's Anybody who runs a business knows a quick interruption, not necessarily a money saver.
But, I think we also have to be clear, because this is the logic of a government shutdown is that obviously if you're being paid by the government and that paycheck stops temporarily, because they will get back pay if past is any indication. But that dodges the question, and I think Ryan and I would agree on this, it dodges the question of whether or not that person should be on the federal payroll to begin with. And you could even take it to things, people are talking about national parks all the time, and they're shut down, and that's horrible, and that's awful. I personally don't agree with that. But the one thing I know for sure is that you don't need the federal government to be running national parks. And there are thousands of national sites that, that are run by the U.S. Park Service.
An argument to privatize.
No, not necessarily privatize, or to give it to the states or open it up. States like Arizona, who had a bunch of failing state parks, they had people, they had private interests who were willing to pay them for the privilege of running those money-losing parks.
All right.
Why not think about redoing the way business as usual has led us to record deficits, record debt, and no way out?
All right, we're running out of time, but I got a very quick question for both of you. We talk about government dysfunction, and this whole thing is about government dysfunction. Do you see, yes or no, any function in any of this that's gone on? Ryan Alexander, anything functioning?
Well, I think that one thing we've seen in the last 2 years since the Budget Control Act is I do think we've seen kind of more movement in the direction of reducing our defense spending and Pentagon spending, and that's good. There used to be kind of fiscal hawks and defense hawks. They weren't the same. Now we're seeing some fiscal hawks say, you know what, I can be a defense hawk and cut some defense spending. That's good.
That's Ryan Alexander is president of Taxpayers for Common Sense. Any function here, Nick Gillespie?
Yeah, I do think that it has forced the American people to force their government to say you can't keep spending more money than you're taking in year after year after year.
So it's functioning in having changed the debate at the
Absolutely.
Very least. Nick Gillespie is the editor-in-chief of Reason.com and Reason TV. Thanks to you both. Later this hour, how being diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease doesn't have to be the end, but could offer a different beginning.
Life is not over. It's a terrible disease, but there is life in the disease.
Writer, Alzheimer's expert David Shank is with us on how people find life and love, even as they live with Alzheimer's. Stay with us.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.